Good morning, listeners. I'm your host, Scott Bland. Welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. On this one, we are wrapping up election night.
AP called Underwood. Fox is called DeSantis in Florida. Gillum is conceding? Okay. Scott, I think it's time to pull the trigger. I'm ready to call the house. Literally, I have a button that lets me slide control of the house over to the left for Democrats or over to the right, and then a button where I press save. All right, time to push the button. This thing is over.
Democrats took the House, Republicans padded their majority in the Senate, and if you're looking for a neat and tidy storyline to take from the evening, you are out of luck. Voters sent a couple different messages tonight. There may be a Trump-centric way, though, of knitting them together. Donald Trump's election in 2016 accelerated some trends that were already happening in American politics, and he's really remade the Republican Party as the party of rural America. And that worked out in some of the states he won in 2016 and some states where Republicans won big races in 2018. But in so doing, he traded away the suburbs where Republicans had built their electoral strategy for a long time. And by trading away the suburbs, he may have traded away the House of Representatives. We're going to break it all down. Let's bring in our roundtable. We've got senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian here. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Scott.
We've got our House reporter Elena Schneider. Hi, Elena.
Hey, Scott.
We've got our race raider, button pusher, polling expert, Steve Shepard.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
I should mention at this point that it is a little bit after 3 a.m., and we're all a little punchy.
I'm drunk on Diet Snapple.
So, and also, all of this information could change. You know, there's still a few uncalled races out there and stuff, so there's all this information is subject to change. However, there are some things that we absolutely know. The House has flipped. Democrats won the House. The result we've all been thinking about and talking about and wondering about for basically a couple of years now, it happened. We're looking at Democrats have picked up 27 seats so far that they've netted. Nothing has been called yet in California where, as you know, there are a ton of toss-up races and that those could take a while because of the mail balloting and the late voting there. So we don't know exactly the size, but we do know that Democrats took back the House. So, Elena, how did this come together?
I think what we saw happen last night, I would sort of start it again as we talked about with the way we would start it, you know, several weeks ago, which is in Kentucky 6 and Virginia 7. That was an early result that I was, those were two early results that I was watching really closely. And they went two different ways. Kentucky 6, Andy Barr was able to hold on, beating Amy McGrath, who had raised over $8 million to try and take him on. And Virginia 7 saw the opposite. Dave Brat went down after Abigail Spanberger was able to take him out. And I think that Republicans had a few bright spots that they could look to. Brian Mast held on in Florida. Brian Fitzpatrick held on in Pennsylvania 1. But overall, what we really saw was more results like Virginia 7th, which was just a true bloodbath in the suburbs, where members from suburbs ringing Denver, Chicago, all kind New York,
Minneapolis, Dallas,
I'm forgetting cities now, all went down in pretty striking fashion. In particular, I'm definitely thinking about Pete Sessions outside of Dallas and John Culberson outside of Houston, both of whom had not faced serious campaigns in a long time and were both taken out in this wave.
Charlie, scale of 1 to 10, how bad was the GOP crash and burn in the suburbs?
10. I don't think you can overstate it. No, seriously. I mean, if you like Elena said, virtually every big city was affected by this. I mean, you just run down the list. I mean, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, Chicago, Philly, every one of them had a Republican incumbent either go down in flames or barely escape by the skin of their teeth. And what's amazing about that is, I mean, the suburbs were the bedrock of the Republican Party for a half century. Where does the party go now that that whole level has been stripped out of it? And there is no question about who owns that. That is all on Donald Trump. The suburbs sent a message in 2016 that they were deeply uncomfortable with President Trump, or at the time, candidate Trump, and the Republican Party didn't listen. And now they got their comeuppance. And so the question will be, what do the political survivors, how do they respond to this? Do they continue to move in lockstep with the president, or do they buck him? Because suddenly the calculus has changed for all of these suburban Republicans. And then the other problem the Republicans face is, okay, without this suburban contingent, do you just become a smaller, more concentrated conservative rural party? Where do you go if you're that party?
Well, I think the answer is that you do go to rural America. And we saw that work for maybe not in the confines of these House districts that were drawn mostly by Republicans at a time when they thought they owned these suburbs. But in states like Florida and Ohio, I mean, Florida really sticks out to me. And Steve, we were talking about this earlier tonight, about how well Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson, Democratic nominees for governor and Senate, did even in some traditionally Republican big counties like Duval in Florida's northeast, where Jacksonville is. That's the biggest city in Florida. It's always tilted a little bit Republican. That was where Republicans kind of rolled up some big margins. Both Gillum and Nelson won that, but they, like Hillary Clinton in 2016, they got swamped outside, the further outside you got in the big cities, and those little margins in rural counties just added up and up and up.
You can look at the national picture for the House and just look at the exit poll and see President Trump's approval rating at 45%, disapproval 54%, and then go state by state in some of these Senate battlegrounds, including places where, yes, the president visited in the final weeks of the campaign, and look at Florida, where his approval rating is over 50%, or look at Missouri, or look at Indiana. Then compare it to places where he didn't go, Nevada, Wisconsin. His approval rating is well under 50% in those places. That definitely seems like that is where Republicans go. That was a path to victory tonight in the Senate. It may be a path to holding the Senate as we get closer to 2020, and it may be a path to the Electoral College in 2020, but it's not a path right now to the House majority.
Yeah, it was a path to some solid governor's wins for the GOP in Florida. They kept Florida, they kept Ohio, they kept Iowa. Scott Walker did go down in Wisconsin, Democrats beating him on the fourth attempt there after two regular elections and a recall. And Democrats did pick up, about a half dozen governorships around the country, and we're still waiting on calls in a few. I think Nevada is still uncalled as of this taping and some others. But definitely, if you had talked to us last week and you had said, hey, like Democrats could pick up 30-plus seats in the House, we wouldn't have figured that, you know, Kim Reynolds was going to be winning re-election in Iowa and Ron DeSantis was going to be winning the governor's race in Florida, right, Elena? Just those seemed like two outcomes that didn't fit with each other.
Right. We're living in two different realities right now, and that feels sort of a perfect encapsulation where the country is right now. We watched as Republicans were able to make real inroads in these rural, massive Senate states where they were able to run up big numbers. And then at the same time, you know, I had a Republican, Tom Davis, the former NRCC chairman, crystallized it for me when he said, we traded country club Republicans for the country, which I think is very much what's happening in these House districts. So you have sort of in these massive Senate states that are largely rural, that works. And in these smaller House districts that are based around these suburban areas, the opposite happens.
Yeah, Charlie, walk us through the Senate map, if you can. As we tape, it looks like Republicans have netted at least two seats so far. We've got Democratic incumbents losing in Indiana, Missouri, and North Dakota, but a Republican losing in Nevada. And then we've still got a couple races that are still yet to be decided.
Yeah, we've got a couple of big ones that are still out there. I mean, what's interesting is you're beginning to see how our polarization really works in practice with these Senate races, where the presidential map is becoming almost completely aligned with the Senate map, where red states elect red senators. And there's less and less room for a state to vote one way for president and another way for the Senate. I mean, what we have right now, at least as we're taping this at this ungodly hour at 3:43 a.m., you still got the Montana tester race still undecided, Arizona undecided, Florida. And what's interesting here is what implications they have for 2020 for Donald Trump as well, because Florida obviously is central and essential to his reelection campaign. So we'll learn a little something about where Florida voters are. And same thing with Arizona, because we could see, you know, the prospect of a new path and some new states come into play in as candidates think about the path to victory in 2020. Arizona maybe is in play. Maybe Georgia is in play, even though Stacey Abrams lost in the governorship there. So, I mean, I think overall it was not a great night for Democrats, because Republicans may end up expanding, you know, to a certain degree, their majority there. But at the same time, we also have to remember this was, in some ways, like arguably the single worst Senate map for a party since the introduction of direct elections in the Senate. I mean, that's how bad it was, just because of the vagaries of the political map this year. I mean, it was just the luck of the draw. Dems had a bad draw. They had an awful, awful map. It actually could have been worse. So I'm not trying to minimize things. It was a good night for Republicans. They came out on top. They might come out even, you know, shining a little brighter. But having said that, it could have been devastating for the Democrats
in the Senate. Hey, yeah. Let's talk about, speaking of that map, it looks like one of the four or five closest races on that Senate map is going to be Texas, where Ted Cruz has won re-election, but Beto O'Rourke is, what, about 2.5-3 points behind him at this point. That's got to be the closest Senate race, probably closest major statewide race in Texas in decades.
Yeah, but okay, I think everybody here knows I'm not on the Beto bandwagon. Like, I'm so over the Beto O'Rourke campaign. And don't get me wrong, Beto O'Rourke ran a great campaign. You know, I don't want to take anything away from that.
You're just tired of hearing about it.
Tired of the hysteria surrounding his candidacy. And here's the thing. Cruz still won. You know, Beto still doesn't hit 50% there, despite spending ungodly amounts of money. He raised $38 million in a quarter. Who does that? I mean, that's just remarkable. I think it was more just sort of a testament of, you know, just how angry the progressive base is and small Democratic small donors are and how much energy they have. And they poured all of their hopes and dreams into this one campaign because Ted Cruz makes their heads explode and they wanted to take him out. And in the end, you know, I wonder if maybe that energy might have been better placed elsewhere.
That being said, though, I do think that there were Beto coattails. I don't know if Lizzie Fletcher would have won in Houston or Colin Allred in Dallas if Beto wasn't running.
Two big flips for House
Democrats. Two huge flips for House Democrats, both that were considered, you know, in the outer tier of maybes for them. And then on top of that, Will Hurd, who looks at this point like he's still going to be able to manage to hold on.
That's really close, though.
But it's within hundreds of votes, and that's another incredibly difficult district. So, yes, I totally agree that they're, a lose is still a lose, but he was able to help lift some of these down ballot candidates that are going to remake these Texas suburbs and create a bench for future statewide candidates in Texas.
That's a fantastic point, I have to admit.
I wonder also if it's going to be a catalyst for, you know, there's another Senate race coming up in 2020. Presumably the governorship's going to be open again at some point in the future if Greg Abbott decides he wants to do something else or has national ambitions or anything. And
but what about Beto? Does he run for president now? I mean, it's that kind of talk that drives me crazy.
Who cares?
He was a backbench House member, and now people are going to look at him as some sort of liberal martyr, and he will show up on the prospects for 2020.
But here's what I do wonder, though. Does O'Rourke's performance demonstrate to other Texas Democrats who might not have been interested in running that they should be doing this? Just like, you know, does Jim Renacci's performance in Ohio, where he ran a pretty stiff, lifeless campaign against Democrat Sherrod Brown and only lost by 6 points, you know, does that get Republicans coming out of the woodwork in Ohio to run statewide who might not have thought about it before? I'm really curious what the future political candidates make of these trends that we are just starting to unpack tonight as these states change so rapidly.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned those two states because they were had roughly the same margin of victory for Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential race.
But they're moving past each other.
Moving in vastly opposite directions. Texas was much closer in 2016 than it was in 2012, whereas Ohio swung from a narrow Obama victory in 2012 to an 8-point Trump victory in 2016. These states are moving in opposite directions, and I do think that O'Rourke's candidacy does tell other Texas Democrats, hey, maybe the water's not fine, but the water's not terrible. and you might have a shot here with the right national environment and with the right campaign. Texas, it's huge. There's a lot of people. It's difficult to build a winning campaign there. It's difficult to raise the money and get people to believe in you to run the TV campaign you need to run. So you need to do something different. What's interesting is because it's so large, it's a big prize in the 2020 presidential race. And if Democrats look at this, depending on the candidate they nominate in 2020, sure, you know, I think we could see some campaign activity there. I know that sounds crazy that Democrats might contest Texas. But depending on the nominee that they choose, I know it's cost prohibitive, but 38 electoral votes, that's a lot to leave on the table on a state that is getting better for you. Just look at the exit poll today. Democratic Party had roughly the same fave-unfave as the Republican Party. Voters were actually split, despite the fact that Cruz won. Voters were split on which party they wanted to control the U.S. Senate. This may not be your... Better work may not be your grandfather's candidate. Texas is not your grandfather's Texas.
And I'm not saying that Colin Allred or Lizzie Fletcher is ready to run for 2020, but we did just see Jackie Rosen, who was a first-time candidate who had never run before, elevated from a first-term congressional position into a Senate race that she's now won. So crazier things have happened.
All right, we need to wrap up here. We need to finish up our stories. We need to put our heads on some pillows soon before we all die. Before we go, real quick, let's go around the table. Charlie, most interesting thing you saw tonight?
I would say Marsha Blackburn's victory in the Tennessee Senate race. This was a race where we were led to believe that this was neck and neck. Marsha Blackburn was really struggling with the Republican base, couldn't connect with moderate Republicans in Eastern Tennessee. And in the end, she won pretty comfortably. And I think it just goes to show you just how strong the Republican Party is in Tennessee. And there's really no daylight for Tennessee Democrats anymore there, because Phil Bredesen had won there before, ran a strong campaign, was well-financed, and in the end lost by a pretty big margin.
Elena, what you got?
So I know that we've been beating the drum about the suburbs being a big deal forever, but the depths to which that was the case really was borne out in Oklahoma City, where a no-name Democratic candidate, Kendra Horn, was able to take out.
Well, she clearly has a name.
Well, okay. A unknown, largely unknown Democratic candidate was able to take out Congressman Steve Russell there. That was pretty shocking, and I don't think that many, myself included, saw that one coming.
Absolutely. It's one of my patented 4 a.m. jokes right there. All right, Steve, take us out.
We spent a lot of time back in June talking about the Dan Donovan-Michael Grimm primary on Staten Island and how Michael Grimm was coming back for his old seat after his tax evasion imprisonment. And when Dan Donovan beat him, we thought, well, this is a safe seat for Republicans. It snapped hard toward Donald Trump. Dan Donovan is squeaky clean, former DA, as opposed to Michael Grimm and the ex-con. Dan Donovan lost tonight to Max Rose, Democratic candidate. I'm a New Yorker, so I'm going to choose the biggest race in New York. Donald Trump's home city, hometown, zero Republicans in the House now. Mm. That was the last one wiped out.
That's really interesting. All right, there's plenty more to unpack. So much happened in this election, but we got to stop here. We're going to pick it up again on a future episode. Charlie, thank you so much for taking the time tonight.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Steve, well done tonight with all the calls. Did a great job.
We're all going to stay up straight through tomorrow and keep going, right?
And Elena, a big round of applause to you, metaphorically speaking, because we don't want to upset the microphones, but great job covering the House this cycle.
Thank you so much.
This bonus episode was produced by Jenny Ament. Our executive producer is Dave Shaw. Nerdcast's illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you appreciated the insight in this episode, there's a way you can say thanks. Share the show with a friend. And leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. We'll be back in your ears with a new episode out Friday, because not only is there plenty more to unpack, but oh yeah, the 2020 presidential race is probably going to get started in about 5 minutes. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will talk to you again soon.
So this is election. When you're a political reporter, you spend your whole 2 year cycle building up to this night. Unlike some things where it's difficult to, you don't get answers. In politics and elections, at least, you get answers. The voters have their say, and we can spend 2 years talking about what might happen. And you can argue in the newsroom, or you can argue at the bar over who's going to win. But ultimately, you find out, and that kind of finality is something that appeals to me.